All right, about to start. All righty. Good afternoon, everyone. We are starting this special session of the Oregon Investment Council. Just as a reminder, this is primarily focused on training for the Oregon Investment Council members. The official December meeting is on December 8th at the usual time of 9 a.m. Just a few items before we proceed forward with the agenda. As always, this meeting is being recorded, and the audio portion of this meeting will be provided on the Treasury website shortly after the meeting. Also, there is a Q&A function as a part of the Teams app or on your web browser. If you're having any kind of technical issues, please use that Q&A function to submit those issues to us. And then lastly, for this meeting, we will not be having any public comments. That said, we are accepting all public comments for the December 8th meeting. And as usual, we will supply all of those written comments in the public materials that is provided. And with that, Chair Russell.
Rex, I think I'm happy to just turn the meeting over to you.
All right, sounds good. Well, let's proceed forward to the agenda. And with that, let's start with the very first agenda item. And I believe it's Mr. Emkin.
First, we'll do the sound check. So I assume you can hear me. Great, thank you. First and foremost, Mr. Chair, members of the council, participants, thanks for the opportunity. When I was asked to do this session, it forced me to do some soul searching because I truly go way, way back with the Oregon Investment Council. I've had the privilege of working with the council since 1983. During my tenure, there had been 6 governors, 9 chairs of the council, a number of whom served multiple terms, 8 state treasurers, and 5 CIOs. I've seen a lot. And as I was collecting my thoughts, I could not have done it nearly as effectively without the help of Mike Mueller, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of the OIC and is more than willing to share it. Jerry Drummond, who I met with out here in the desert because he was the chair for a number of years, and the inimitable Richard Solomon. And I had the benefit of talking to all of them because they were pretty key people in the evolution of the OIC. So going back in history, we can go to page, please. The first data point that I could find was in 1966. And to put a human element on that, that is the year I graduated high school. It was a long time ago. Jim George, who became quite famous in the public pension plan world, was the second CIO, and he was the CIO at that point. And total treasury assets were $200 million. Hard to believe, the various portfolios had a collected value of $200 million. Shortly after that, 1967, the legislature passed the Investment Act, which created the OIC. It adopted the prudent person rule with a constraint on the ability to use equities. Things stayed pretty much the same until the 70s, when a representative from the retirement fund was appointed to the OIC, and that was Roger Meyer. And Roger Meyer is truly a storied person, not just in public pension plan world and not just in the OIC, but truly in the investment community. He's probably most famous for having the OIC be the first real big-time investor in KKR, and the most well-known investment was in Fred Meyer. Why that's important was there were no public pension plans investing in private equity at that point in history. And not only was it unique for that reason, but the commitment was 8% of the total assets of the portfolio. So we were in uncharted water with a big bet. History will show that it was a very, very good bet, and it really worked, but it was not without controversy.
Alan, if I may, it's John Russell.
Of course.
The context is important here. First of all, Roger Meyer was my partner in the development of PacWest Center, and in his own investments was very cautious. I think at that point in time, we could have funded the PERS obligations out of bonds alone, or close to it. And I think that explains the 67 constraint on public equity. So,
that's really good input. And the world was changing dramatically in the 70s. There was the adoption of ERISA, which basically forced corporate and Taft-Hartley pension plans to adopt the prudent person rule. It required diversification, and it required the exclusive benefit rule, where you really only could put the money to work for the benefit of the beneficiaries. That had not been the case before. In fact, there were a whole series of scandals about corporate pension plans and Taft-Hartley pension plans evaporating, which really was the motivation for ERISA. And in fact, ERISA became the model for most public pension plans' legal structure over the next decade. Not only did Roger start the push on private equity, but he also was the first public pension plan to commit monies to real estate, international stocks, and to a whole variety of active equity managers. But at that point, all of the fixed income was managed internally. There were no external managers. Slide, please. So that first private equity transaction with KKR was 1982. No, it wasn't the first. The first was Norris Industries, which is a much smaller deal, which literally resulted in a triple. So that gave the support that this concept of private equity would work. And Roger worked directly with KKR on the Fred Meyer transaction. At that point, the staff was a handful of people. Very important to remember that. Inflation was in the low teens. At that point, you could have locked up for 30 years a mid-teen return in the treasury market. And when we talk about inflation today and people are anxious about 3 or 4% inflation, those of us who remember the 60s and 70s from a capital market perspective, who lived through it, know the damage that inflation can do to an investment portfolio. But once inflation was brought under control through draconian actions by the Federal Reserve resulting in short-term interest rates in the high teens and low 20s, for the next 40 years, interest rates did nothing but go down. There were some bumps along the way. But I remember when you could get a Ginnie Mae yielding 16.5%. And when you could get mid-teens on treasuries, and in fact, you could have immunized the whole portfolio had there been adequate and gotten out of the investment business.
Alan, again, let me interject. I'm not convinced that inflation is a bad thing for our investment portfolio, particularly given that there's an 8% issue in the contributions. Inflation may well be the safety, the saving grace of a pension fund with fixed obligations.
This is probably better discussed at another time, but I guess the big issue on inflation is what level of inflation, and is it unanticipated inflation? And at very high rates of inflation, it just destroys wealth. And to the extent that benefits are linked to inflation, it also increases benefits. But let's go, Colin Beebe is going to be on later to talk about asset allocation. I think he's much better qualified than I am to deal with that. So Roger was the chair, and then a really talented woman named Carol Hewitt became the chair. She was a local lawyer. Very sadly, she passed away young, but she carried on that tradition. And literally the staff didn't really grow. Assets began to grow because bonds rallied and equities rallied post-1983. And as bond yields came down, equity values and earnings rose, and the portfolio became much more dynamic. In 1993, which was really pretty early for this, the fund hired Wells Fargo as an index fund manager. And indexation at that point, although there was a lot of it, it really wasn't common. As opposed to today, where literally more than half of all the assets in most institutional portfolios, publicly traded equities, are indexed. It wasn't until 2008, until the system hired their first external fixed income manager. Until that time, it was all managed in-house. And there was another famous person whose name was Bill Ungersat, who ran that portfolio, who is very well known in the investment community because he was an early big supporter of mortgage-backed securities, which for some of you will find this interesting. In the early 80s, many institutional investors considered mortgage-backed securities real estate and not fixed income. And literally, they had mortgage backs in their real estate portfolio. And that just shows you how the world and the capital markets change over time. In 2012, the portfolio had grown much more complex. The staff had grown modestly, but there was a recognition that the level of complexity required a deeper dive into the organization and the portfolio structure. At that point, the performance was excellent, in no small part because of private equity. Staffing was still nominal. And based upon the Funston report, which if you haven't had an opportunity to look at it, I encourage you to do so. There was a whole series of recommendations, many of which eventually were adopted to improve both the governance and the structure of the staff. But to throw out some quick statistics, Funston quoted from a report that was done by a group called Cutter Associates, and it compared Oregon staffing and resources to those of a medium-sized public fund peer. In terms of investment portfolio management trading, Oregon at that point had 15 people. The average fund had 30. In terms of risk management, Oregon had zero. The average had a little bit less than three. Accounting, Oregon had 6 people. The average had 36. Business analysts, and I'm not exactly sure what a business analyst is, but they have it here. You had 0, and there were 4.2 at the average fund. Information services, You had four, the average had 23. The total was you had a gross staff of 25 people. Your average peer had almost 100. Slide, please. Based in large part because the advocacy of the state treasurer, the council, and that report, the legislature dramatically increased the funding authority for the OIC. That began an increase in staffing and in technology with the adoption of Aladdin. And in retrospect, one would have thought that bringing on Aladdin would have been an easy thing to do. But there was an enormous amount of anxiety because it was this unbelievably strong, sophisticated analytical tool, and it was expensive on a relative basis. And there were a number of meetings on whether or not to incorporate Aladdin. It eventually was. It was eventually well-staffed and is today the background of the risk management system that your staff and you look at to oversee the portfolio. The portfolio has become increasingly complex. If anyone would have told anyone on the council in 1985 or 95 or 05 that you would have hundreds of managers, that you would have a large and sophisticated staff, that your assets would be of the size they are, and that you would be a truly global investor investing in all sorts of strategies, they would have said that can't be true.
Alan, let me interrupt you one more time, because I'm only a year older than younger than you are. So an important context for this time frame is that the greater funding authority came as a trade-off. As I remember, the state treasurer at the time wanted us to be completely independent from the legislature in terms of our funding. So the legislature turned that down, but did increase the funding. And then that's the current status.
Right. That was, in fact, something that the council considered, and it was the original recommendation, and that was ended up being unacceptable to the policymakers.
And there was also a little bit of a time lag. Those things happen in separate legislative sessions, but otherwise you're totally right.
So for me, it's been a privilege to work for the council through all of this evolution, through all of the board members and the various CIOs and the staff. But what do I take away from it? If there's anything that my experience gives me, it's the ability to try to put some context. You have always been an organization with strong and effective leadership. The chairs of the council have been vigilant in protecting the assets of the fund and always putting the members' benefits and the members' concerns first. There's been enormous continuity. It's hard to believe how many people on the staff have been there for a long time, and sometimes even harder to believe the length of time some board members have been willing to spend on the council, taking time away from their other pursuits and their families. It's really a fascinating and very, very good example of true public service. What was once a really thin and under-resourced staff has been built out, and it's become deeper and well-resourced. And as time goes on, you're going to need more resources. But you're well along the way towards having the type of staffing that's needed to meet the challenges that we face. Performance long-term has been excellent, in no small part because of the commitment to growth equity, particularly to private equity. But some things hurt. There were some bets in the portfolio on factors that didn't pan out. At least they haven't panned out yet. Today, the portfolio and the staff looks much more similar to your peers than it has in the past. And I think that's both a good thing and a bad thing. That's something we could discuss. But the key is that for years and today, the Oregon Investment Council is viewed universally as one of the best investors in its space in the country. And it's been a privilege to work with you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about the history.
Alan, once again, it's John Russell. I'm curious. We've had a strong council because of the fact that we're all appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, and it's a relatively small group. Are we unique with other entities? How are other council members chosen?
Well, this morning I was on a three-hour Zoom call with the Minnesota State Board of Investment, which is comprised of the four constitutional officers. So literally it's the governor, the attorney general, the secretary of state, and the state auditor. Then they have a very large advisory council, which is made up of the creme de la creme of the investment people in the Twin Cities area, along with members of the various retirement systems. I failed to mention one thing. Not only are you fiduciaries, but you have a range of clients, which in some ways makes you unique, because most of our clients are just investing for pension plans. You invest for the common school fund. You invest for an insurance company. You have this range of clients, all of them unique needs, and have different objectives. And it's important to recognize that's a level of complexity that many of your peers don't have. Historically, the appointments to the OIC have been based strictly on merit. There are people who come out of the community who have real knowledge of finance and capital markets from all different perspectives, and that's truly added to the results because they ask really, really good questions and are not afraid to challenge anyone who goes before you. And if there's one trait that you as collectively counsel have over the years, it's you've never been embarrassed to ask a really hard question, no matter who's presenting before you. And absent anything else, I'm done.
All right. Thank you, Alan. Really appreciate that history. Next up are Jenna Cullen for the next two items, fiduciary responsibility and governance. And then thereafter for Hot Topics for Institutional Investors will be Jenna with Kristen Doyle.
So hello, everyone. I hope you can hear me, although unfortunately I can't see you and you can't see me. Are the slides up?
Yes, they are. And we can hear you just great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. So it's an honor to be here with you all today, albeit remotely, to go over fiduciary responsibility and governance. Hopefully, as I'm going through this presentation, you'll get a sense of redundancy here. A lot of what I'm going to say, Alan alluded to already with respect to ERISA and fiduciary responsibilities, the importance of governance, the importance of independence. So with that in mind, I'm going to get started. Slide two, please. So slide two talks about some of the things we're going to talk about. The origin of fiduciary responsibility, which I think is very important because fiduciary responsibilities aren't necessarily something that is very easy to understand, okay? And so understanding the origins of fiduciary responsibility hopefully will make it easier for you to understand how it all fits together. Then we're going to talk about what your key fiduciary responsibilities are, and then fiduciary liability and prohibited transactions. And as Rex said, we're going to do governance. What is governance? Why is it important? What are some of the pitfalls around that? Again, Alan mentioned some of them, and I'll point them out as well. And then what are some of the practices that you have implemented, can implement to mitigate those pitfalls? And last but not least, my colleague Kristen Doyle is going to talk about some of the hot topics for institutional investors, specifically cybersecurity, ESG, and proxy voting. So let's jump to slide 4. And slide 4 identifies some of the things that you should think about today as I'm talking. And I encourage you, if you've got a question, please feel free to interrupt me, all right? This is one of the instances where it's okay to interrupt someone because asking a question that you have on your mind is a good thing, and it helps to ingrain the training process. So we'll talk about...
This is John Russell, and I've never hesitated to ask a question. I would add one other hot topic other than cyber and ESG, and that is the whole issue of Bitcoin and you know, the various new forms of money.
Okay. I'm going to punt that to Kristen to talk about or Makita to talk about when they're doing investments. Okay. But thank you for bringing that up because that is sort of a hot topic. I remember with one fund that it was a client, I was going to talk about it, and I was specifically told not to talk about it because it was too controversial. And as Alan pointed out, you need to talk about the controversial things. You need to talk about, you know, what you're thinking, even if there's diversity of opinion. But we'll get to that when we talk about governance. All right. We'll talk about who's the fiduciary, what are your fiduciary responsibilities, and how do you mitigate fiduciary liability. Just as a disclaimer, even though I am an attorney, the purpose of today's training is not to provide legal advice. If you've got a legal question, it's important that you ask your legal counsel. Slide 5. So why is this training needed? Well, the one reason is because members of the OIC are the primary governing fiduciaries, and you have a fiduciary responsibility for the funds under your purview. Fiduciary responsibilities are the highest known to law, okay? And, you know, courts have consistently held that. It's important, as I mentioned, to understand, you know, what's the genesis of fiduciary responsibility and what their purpose was. ERISA was enacted as a reform piece of legislation. And as we'll talk about, ERISA was modeled after trust law. And most public funds have their fiduciary standards either modeled after the prudent investor standard or ERISA standards, which are very, very similar. Not exact, but very, very similar. So engaging in orientation and ongoing training is consistent with good governance, and I know you're an organization that wants to and does employ good governance, and it's a best practice. And last but certainly not least, Oregon law requires continuing education for the members of the OIC related specifically to fiduciary duties and best practice. Okay, so let's jump to slide 7 and talk about the genesis of fiduciary standards. So, as I said, the funds are held in trust. And so because they're held in trust, basic principles of trust law apply. Now, principles of trust go back 100 years, almost as old as Alan and I. All right. They were started in England, and they've been developed over the, by courts over time. And they were applied initially to families and businesses and charitable trusts. And now they're applied to pension funds. And they're applied to pension funds, as I said, through your applicable statutes or through ERISA. And I'll talk about in just a minute why you keep hearing me talk about ERISA. Now, and these general trust law principles set forth the fiduciary standards that your fiduciary standards ultimately emanate from. There are three parties to a trust. There's the settlor, and the settlor is the entity that creates the trust, designs the trust. And in the case of public pension funds, the settlor is the governmental entity or your legislature, all right? Then you've got the trustees, and in this case, you all are the trustees. And then you've got the beneficiaries of the trust, whether it be the participants in the retirement fund, or as Alan alluded to, you all have a number of other clients that are the beneficiary of your investment stewardship. And I actually have a slide later that names what some of those are. So what are the sources of fiduciary responsibility? So for the OIC, it's your state law. And I've given a cite there to what the two key provisions in state law are. There are other provisions of state law that apply to the OIC, but they don't relate to fiduciary standards. They relate to other requirements such as conflicts of interest and obligations that you have with respect to disclosure and that type of thing. You have the restatement of trust, second, the restatement of trust, third. That one was very, very important because it created the prudent investor rule. And the OIC law is modeled after the prudent investor rule, not ERISA. And we'll talk about how those are similar and a little different. You've got ERISA, the Prudent Investor Act, the Internal Revenue Code, which deals with tax qualifications, case law, and attorney general opinions. Slide 7. So you keep hearing me mention, I'm confused. Which slide? It should be slide 9. Is that the slide that you have up, guys?
We do now, yes. Slide 9 is up.
All right. So why do you keep hearing me talk about ERISA and what's its relevance? Well, ERISA is the federal law that governs the operations and administration of private pension plans, corporate plans, and welfare plans. All right? ERISA does not apply to governmental plans such as the OIC. However, it is very, very influential in providing guidance. If your law doesn't specifically address a fiduciary standard or a definition, it is highly likely that courts will look to the ERISA standards. And as I mentioned earlier, most public funds model their laws either from the Prudent Investor Act or from ERISA. So let's skip to slide 11. So you hear the term fiduciary. Who is a fiduciary? So Black's Law Dictionary defines a fiduciary as one who owes to another duties of good faith, trust, confidence, and candor. All right? Extrapolating that further, ERISA and many public pension plans define it based on the individual's function. So they call it a functional test. Whether or not you're a fiduciary is a functional test. So the test is whether or not an individual has discretionary authority and control over the administration of the plan or the management of the plan's assets. Now, you don't have to exercise that discretion, but if you have that discretion by virtue of the law or by virtue of your actions, even though you may not be designated in the law, then you are a fiduciary. You cannot avoid your fiduciary status through documentation stating, I'm not a fiduciary, okay? For example, investment consultants used to try to do that all the time, saying, we're not fiduciaries. And there is actually a court case that says, if you look like a duck and walk like a duck, you're a duck. So if you're exercising discretionary authority and control, it does not matter whether or not you say, I'm not a fiduciary, you will be deemed a fiduciary. Now, if you don't have discretionary authority and control, if you are performing ministerial functions, if you are following specific direction that was given to you, you are not likely to be a fiduciary. The other way to become a fiduciary is by designation. And many public funds have laws, statutes, that actually designate who is a fiduciary. All right? So it's typically members of a council or a board. It may designate the CIO. It may designate, members of the investment staff, specifically as fiduciaries. The other way is by written delegations of authority. So if the OIC delegates authority to the staff, then by virtue of that delegation, the staff could become, or it would become, a fiduciary. It's important to also remember that fiduciary duty and your fiduciary status is limited to the scope of your responsibility delegated to you. So you may be a fiduciary for one purpose, but not a fiduciary for another. Now, with respect to the OIC, you all don't have specific statutory language that defines who is a fiduciary or a designation, therefore. You use the term, or the term fiduciary is used in documentation, but there is no definition. Slide 12. This is the specific ERISA definition of a fiduciary. If you exercise discretionary authority or control over the management of the plan or the management or disposition of plan assets, if you render investment advice for a fee or other compensation, I call this the investment consultant definition of fiduciary, all right? Or you have any discretionary authority or discretionary responsibility regarding the administration of the plan, all right? That's more for retirement plans than it would be for investment councils. There are three types of fiduciaries. There is what we refer to as a 316 fiduciary, which is the plan administrator, or it can be the plan sponsor. You have a 321 fiduciary, and that's the fiduciary that exercises discretion over the plan assets, which would be board members, council members, and your traditional investment consultant. That is a consultant who provides advice without discretion. And then the one that we've heard more about recently is the 338 fiduciary, which is your typical investment managers, but it's also some investment consultants who have been delegated authority. And because they're not just rendering advice, they also have discretion. They are deemed to be a 338 fiduciary. Investment consultants can be a 321 and a 338 fiduciary at the same time. So, slide 13. This is an overview of your typical fiduciary duties. You have the duty of prudence, to be a prudent expert. You have the duty of loyalty, which will require you to act solely in the interest of the participants, exclusively to provide benefits at a reasonable fee. You have the duty to diversify, the duty to follow plan documents, and the duty to not engage in prohibited transactions. And so we will talk about each of those a little bit now. As I said, ERISA reflects trust law, and therefore its spirit is followed by the courts in the absence of a stated standard in your in-state law. So the next slide is slide 14. So there are basically three different prudence standards, and it's important to know which prudence standard applies to your actions. So there's the prudent reasonable person standard. There's the prudent investor standard, which is the standard that the OIC is subject to. And then there is the prudent expert standard. And so there's often confusion about which standard applies. So the prudent reasonable person standard is a lower standard. The trustee is allowed to observe the standards in dealing with plan assets that would be observed by a prudent man dealing with the property of another or their own property. Okay? Next slide. You have the prudent investor rule, which is a higher standard. I'm on slide 15 now. And that higher standard talks about looking at the whole portfolio, all right, not just individual investments. So whole portfolio theory emanated from the third restatement, also known as the prudent investor rule. Diversification is explicitly required, all right, as part of the duty to prudently invest. No category or type of investment is deemed inherently imprudent. And that's because you're looking at the whole portfolio, not just a single investment, which means you can have risky investments if that risk is mitigated by less risky investments. As a fiduciary, the prudent investor rule allows delegation, all right? Back in the day, there were pension funds that weren't allowed to delegate authority. So, and then that section is just a reiteration of what the prudent investor standard says. So slide 16. So then you have the highest standard, which is the ERISA standard, which is the prudent expert standard. And it requires that a fiduciary discharge their duty with the care, skill, and prudence and diligence under the circumstances, then prevailing. That's very important to know. It's the circumstances then prevailing, acting in a like capacity and familiar with such matters. The familiarity language elevates the standard from a regular prudent person standard to a prudent and expert standard, all right? Also, there is the requirement that you look at like entities with like aims, which means it's important to know what other comparable pension plans your peers are doing. That doesn't mean you have to do the same thing, but knowing what others are doing helps to inform your decision. Slide 17. So in blue, I have the OIC standard. And if you look at it, you'll see investment funds can be invested, okay, and managed as a prudent investor would do under the circumstances then prevailing. So you have that comparable language. And in light of the purposes, terms, distribution requirements, and laws governing each investment fund, all right? The standard requires the exercise of reasonable care, skill, and caution, and is applied to investments not in isolation, but in the context of the entire portfolio, which is the whole portfolio theory that we talked about just a minute ago. Okay? The statutory duty of the OIC is to make the investment funds as productive as possible, subject to the required standard of judgment and care. Slide 18. So it's important to realize that when you're looking at the duty of prudence, fiduciaries are judged by the prudence of their process. And I always tell clients, having a prudent process will not keep you out of the court of public opinion, but it will keep you out of jumpsuit orange, okay? So showing that you followed a prudent process is critical. So how do you do that? On slide 19, the best way to demonstrate that you have followed a prudent process is through written documentation. I cannot overstress the importance of having that written documentation. Prudence requires, the law requires prudence. It does not require perfection. So you can have an investment that doesn't do well, but the key is being able to demonstrate that you followed a prudent process. Slide 20. So we talked about some of your peers. When you're looking at your peers, always remember the devil is in the detail. Okay? So these are some of the other investment boards. In determining whether or not you consider them a peer, you should look at the asset size, what type of entity is, what the level of autonomy is, what the composition is, if you will. I mean, there are boards where you just have statutory officers. So as Alan mentioned Minnesota, all right, Florida State Investment Board. Those are entities where, you have statutory members who sit on them, all right? But there are other boards where that's not the case. The governor is typically making appointments to the council. In some areas, the council may have a lot of independence from the governmental entity or autonomy, as we like to talk about it. In others, that is not the case and can cause problems. Slide 21. So these are some examples of areas where the duty of prudence comes into play, setting the asset allocation, documenting your process, retaining expert assistance, delegation of authority, reviewing performance, managing risk. These are all areas where the duty of prudence would come into play. Slide 22. Remember I talked about under the circumstances then prevailing? So the duty of prudence evolves because the circumstances evolve. What was prudent 20 years ago is likely not prudent today when it comes to doing due diligence around your investments. Your investments are much more complicated and require a greater sense of detail in doing those investments. And the types of investments have changed. 20 years ago, you didn't have Bitcoin. 20 years ago, you didn't have hedge funds. I mean, so all of those things have changed. And because those things have changed, you need more specialized advice from independent consultants and service providers. And it's important to get that advice in written opinions. It's very, very easy for staff, consultants, investment managers to give you off-the-cuff comments. When they have to put it in writing, you would be surprised at how much more thought goes into what they're saying because they know it can come back to bite them. Slide 23, the duty of prudence, as I said, comes in terms of delegation. For the council and the investment officer must act with prudence in deciding whether and how to delegate authority and in the selection and supervision of agents. Agents in this case would be your other service providers, your investment managers, your investment consultant, those types of things. Failure to delegate may be a fiduciary breach because if you don't yourself have the experience, then you need to get an expert to assist you there. So duty of prudence in selecting qualified professionals, duty to specify the scope of any delegation, and then once you've delegated, you have an ongoing duty to monitor those professionals to ensure that the delegation that you made continues to be prudent. As a member of the OIC, you may delegate your authority, but you may not abdicate your responsibility. Okay? In order to do that, slide 24, the Supreme Court has said, separate and apart from the duty of prudence, there is a duty to monitor. All right? Now, in order, though, to carry out that duty to monitor, first, it's important that you establish policies and procedures that the staff can implement, but then it's also important that you have adequate reporting in order to make sure that you have the ability to monitor. So I always say, trust, but verify. It's wonderful to trust your staff and your service providers, but the buck ultimately stops with the OIC, and you may like your staff and your service providers, but you still need to make sure that you know they're doing what you delegated to them to do in the manner in which you prescribed. Slide 24. So the duty of loyalty. The counsel and the investment officer must conform to fundamental fiduciary duties of loyalty and impartiality and incur only costs that are reasonable in amount and appropriate to your investment responsibilities imposed by law. So not exactly what ERISA says, but similar. So the duty of loyalty, also known as the exclusive benefit rule, requires an unwavering commitment to act solely in the best interest of the beneficiaries and participants. It's not about balancing interest. It's about acting solely in their interest. The duty of impartiality emanates from the duty of loyalty and requires a fiduciary to deal fairly and objectively with all fiduciaries. And I've given you some examples of similar statutes from other entities like SWIB. Because they're an OIC, they are to act solely for the purpose of ensuring the fulfillment for each trust and fund at a reasonable cost and not for other purposes. Nebraska, as fiduciaries, appointing members of the council and the state investment officer, shall discharge their duties with respect to the assets solely in the interest of the citizens of the state. So, you know, a little bit more specificity, but the same general idea. Slide 26. The duty of loyalty requires that you avoid conflicts, and if you can't avoid them, disclose and recuse. Now, the OIC has a statutory process for handling conflicts, and it's important. We don't really get into conflicts training in this session, but it's important that you know how to handle conflicts, particularly because there is statutory language that guides how you are supposed to do that. When making decisions, you can't balance interest. When acting as a fiduciary, you may not put others' interest ahead of the beneficiary's interest. And as I said, while the duty of prudence has evolved, the duty of loyalty has not evolved. So the duty to diversify. The OIC is required in making and implementing investment decisions. You have a duty to diversify the investments of the investment funds unless under the circumstances it's not prudent to do so. Very, very similar to the ERISA language. Oftentimes, you don't find that particular language in others' public funds. Sometimes you do. The duty to diversify emanates from the duty of prudence, and modern portfolio theory applies to this one. So in order to diversify, you want to create the optimal portfolio given the risk and return preferences that you have adopted. Okay? Next, on slide 28, you have the duty to follow plan documents. Now, I did not find language applicable to the OIC in your statute that has a duty to follow plan documents, but fiduciaries are required to discharge their duties with respect to a plan in accordance with the documentation and instruments governing the plan. Plan documents typically include your bylaws, your investment policy statement, or other policies adopted by the governing board. Examples of the OIC's plan documents would include the Oregon Law at Chapter 293, the Statement of Investment Objectives and Policy Framework, and your Statement of Fund Governance. Okay, now let's skip to slide 30 and talk a little bit about fiduciary responsibilities. I'm going to pause here and ask, does anyone have any questions about fiduciary standards before I go into fiduciary liability?
Mr. Chair, I actually do have a question. Tobias Reed here, acknowledging your comment about the danger of off-the-cuff comments versus written comments, I'm going to ask one anyway based on one of your earlier slides. I wonder if you could speak a bit more about the interaction between statute and other fiduciary standards when they conflict, how that's best handled.
So I'm not sure I understand. When the statute conflicts with what?
With another fiduciary standard, if there is a prudent investor standard or a duty of loyalty, and there's a statute that doesn't otherwise line up with those.
Is the statute – it might be helpful if you gave me a specific example, because the duty of loyalty is in statute, okay?
Yes.
So, and you're saying that there's another statute that conflicts with that?
I'm imagining a hypothetical statute that might be passed that says we have this other concern that may or may not be in the best interests of the trust or the beneficiary or the purpose, and how that conflict might get resolved.
So are you talking, for example, about divestiture statutes that some entities may feel are not in the best interest of the beneficiaries?
That's certainly an example.
Well, typically it would be the latter statute in time would control, okay? Oftentimes what happens is fiduciaries will want you to put something that the prudence of might be questioned into statute.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when South Africa came along and South Africa required divestiture,
mm-hmm.
there were pension funds that actually sued over that statute. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But as
mm-hmm.
I said, typically the latter statute in time controls, and a statute is a plan document.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about fiduciary liability. You all don't have any specific language in your statute that talks about fiduciary liability. But under ERISA, if you breach your fiduciary responsibilities, you can be found to be fiduciarily liable. And if you are found to have breached your fiduciary responsibilities, you can be personally liable to make good to the plan on any losses resulting from the breach. You could be personally liable to restore any profits which were made through the use of plan assets or other equitable relief. So fiduciary liability is typically viewed as personal liability for losses. But it can also be, you know, loss of reputation or how you go about restoring profit, okay? The attorney-client privilege tends to run to the fund rather than to individual fiduciaries, which is something that can be complex from time to time. Okay.
Yeah, just John Russell, elaborate a bit on that. I was confused when I read that.
So when it says, because typically it's the fund that you are trying to protect. So that's why it's often important if a fiduciary is named in a lawsuit for them to get their own attorney rather than the attorney for the fund, because the attorney for the fund has an obligation to the fund, not to you individually as a fiduciary. Your interest could be conflicting, all right? And that's why we say attorney-client privilege tends to run to the fund and not to the fiduciary. So if you tell your attorney that you've done something, and that attorney is the same attorney for the fund, the attorney, they wouldn't be under an obligation of confidentiality to protect what you've said. Their attorney-client privilege would run to the fund. See what I'm saying?
This is Kara Samples. Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Is any fiduciary liability, would that something that would fall under our E&O insurance?
So, good question. I'm gonna skip to slide 32 for right now. Okay, and then I'll go back to slide 31. So there's no requirement to obtain liability insurance. Most public funds either have the insurance, okay, to protect their personal assets, or the state will provide indemnification. But this is another example where the devil is in the detail. It's also in the detail with respect to fiduciary liability insurance or D&O insurance. They are not the same thing. And D&O insurance typically excludes from coverage any claims based on or arising from fiduciary violations, okay? So D&O insurance typically would cover you in the operation or administration of your job. But if, in fact, you have committed a fiduciary breach, then the D&O coverage wouldn't cover you. So you need fiduciary liability insurance, which is specifically designed to provide insurance protection for the plan and persons in their capacity as fiduciary. Okay, so you need to know, are you covered and what you're covered for? So the devil is definitely in the detail. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Okay. Going back to slide 31. So think of the concept of co-fiduciary liability as you are your brother's keeper, okay? ERISA imposes co-fiduciary liability on any fiduciary who, key here, knowingly participates in or knowingly tries to conceal a fiduciary breach, okay? So the key with the co-fiduciary liability is knowledge. If you knew that another fiduciary is committing a fiduciary breach, you have that knowledge, then you are under an obligation to do something about that. Resignation from your position on the council is not sufficient to terminate your co-fiduciary liability if you knew. And the key again is if you knew. In some cases, there has actually been board members who sought to obtain an injunction to stop other fiduciaries from engaging in a fiduciary breach. That is rare, but it has happened. Okay? Moving on to slide 33. we have the concept of prohibited transactions. So think of prohibited transactions as conflicts of interest. So you're barred from engaging in prohibited transactions. And prohibited transactions relate to personal financial gain, which can impair your decision making. ERISA bars fiduciaries from engaging in those types of transactions to avoid conflicts of interest. Slide 33. So, ERISA bars fiduciaries from engaging in transactions with parties in interest, and parties in interest would be the employer, okay, or in your case, the government, the union, plan fiduciaries, service providers, and statutorily defined owners, officers, and relatives of parties in interest. And prohibited transactions include sale, exchange, or lease of any property between the plan and the party in interest, lending a party in interest money or extensions of credit, and furnishing goods, services, and facilities between a plan and a party in interest. Well, you're probably saying to yourself, well, wait a minute, I know situations where that's allowed, and that's true. As I mentioned early on, ERISA was written as a reform piece of legislation to stop conflicts and protect plan assets. So the prohibited transaction law was written very, very broadly. And as soon as it was written or as part of it, there were exemptions that were allowed so business could continue. So that's why, you know, you'll see, for example, an office building that may have been purchased or built by a retirement fund that also hires a union office within it. So those types of things are permissible, provided that you meet the requirements of the prohibited transaction provisions or what's also referred to as a prohibited transaction exemption. Slide 35. So this is the OIC's version of prohibited transactions. When a person who is a member of the OIC becomes aware that action or a matter pending before the OIC may lead to a private pecuniary benefit, i.e. a self-financial interest, or detriment to the person, to a relative or a person doing business, which the person or relative is associated with, the member has to notify the state treasurer or the deputy state treasurer in writing that that action, decision, or recommendation could constitute an actual or potential conflict of interest. Okay? And then these are the other state requirements that prohibit you from engaging in actions where there can be a financial benefit, okay? Actual conflicts are defined in your state statute, and it requires, your state statute requires compliance with the method for handling conflicts. So as I mentioned, it's very, very important to periodically also engage in conflicts and ethics training. So at some point in the future, in addition to your fiduciary training, you should also have conflicts training. Okay? And last in this area, but not least, is something called self-dealing. So self-dealing is basically a conflict where you use the plan assets for your own interest, or you're acting on both sides of a transaction involving the plan. So, for example, if you do business with an entity that is owned by a member of the OIC, and the OIC member actually votes on the decision to do that. Now, I know you all would never do that, but that would be an example of where self-dealing would come into play and would be prohibited. Okay? Any questions on this before I go to the next section on governance? No?
I don't think okay.
There is. Okay. Hi? Was that a question?
No. Sorry, Jenna. That's, I was just saying that there are no questions.
Oh, okay. So let's go to slide 38, where we're going to talk about what is governance and why is it important. So going to slide 39 now, if we talk about governance, and you use that term a lot, I'm sure, but what does it mean? So governance is the structure, manner, and process by which a board exercises discretionary authority and control. All right? A good governance structure defines the roles and responsibilities of those different parties that participate in the decision-making process. And as part of that, good governance or governance would include an identification of how issues are identified, how alternatives are analyzed or how options are analyzed, how action is taken, and how decisions that you make regarding those actions are evaluated. Adhering to best practices, best governance practices, helps to reduce fiduciary risk by promoting a disciplined, structured process where you have oversight, and it helps to ensure that the fiduciaries are informed and knowledgeable. So understanding your fiduciary responsibilities, which we've just talked about, is fundamental to good governance. Okay? Slide 40, why is good governance important? So we talk about governance, and then we talk about good governance. So good governance policies and practices helps a board to meet its fiduciary responsibilities. It helps to prevent fiduciary breach and minimize risk. And, excuse me, studies have shown that good governance actually enhances the probability of better returns. It reduces the likelihood of litigation, right? Remember I said it helps keep you out of jumpsuit orange. It fosters stakeholder confidence, because stakeholders know and understand what you're doing, and they have that heightens their confidence level in you, okay? And it can make service on the board, or the OIC in this case, more rewarding because it's less stressful and less time-consuming. I used to always say, please keep me out of the paper.
Gina, it's John Russell again. Let me ask you to go back to slide 39.
39.
Yeah, the oversight. Unless I'm mistaken, the only person who actually reports to the board is the chief investment officer. Everybody who reports to that person doesn't necessarily report directly to us. So, if that's true, how do we exercise oversight?
Mr. Chair, it's not true, though. The chief investment officer reports to the treasurer.
And the treasurer sits on the board.
Right.
So, but which your governance structure is somewhat complicated, because you don't have, and you're not alone in this, you don't have direct control over the individuals that are serving you.
Right.
Which means that we have no ability to hold them accountable.
Well, you do have ability to hold them accountable, I would argue, because you do have the ability to adopt policies and processes. And if they have discretion, then they are fiduciaries and should be held to a fiduciary standard. okay? So I would make that argument. So it's even more important for you all to make sure you've got good policies and processes in place and that you've got good reporting in place. Because if you know a fellow fiduciary is violating their fiduciary responsibility, then you have an obligation to do something about it. So you do have a form of control. It's not the direct kind of control that you might ultimately want or need or should have, but it is a form of control.
So if we put good policies and processes in place, and you know, that's a if, that's a big if, but if we do, and then our job is to ensure that the staff is adhering to them and implementing them as we have laid forth, and we feel that they are not, my impression is, of course, we can talk about that and say, we feel that you are not, we feel that things should be done this way, but that's not the ultimate accountability. The treasurer holds that, and what I hear you saying is, well, you do have some ability by saying, hey, you're not fulfilling your fiduciary responsibility. But
right.
Again, if I say that, you know, who do I say that to? The court of law?
Well, let's hope you wouldn't have to take it that far.
Of course.
but the first person that you would say that to, I would suggest, would be the treasurer. Okay? Because the treasurer does have direct responsibility. Okay? And the treasurer is also a fiduciary. Okay? So it would be incumbent on the treasurer to make sure that they are following policy and process. And if they are not, why not? Okay? It may be a situation where, you know, if you have a rule in place that the staff doesn't feel comfortable with, then they should be able to have a discussion with you about why that's not working, why that might not be the most that might not be the best policy to have, how it may impair their ability to do what they need to do.
That's a good answer. That's very helpful.
The issue for me isn't as much control as oversight. I mean, how do we discover that things aren't going the way they should? You know, in my own companies,
okay.
I'm a believer in the old thing about management by walking around. You talk to people a couple levels or more beneath you, and you discover what's really going on. We don't have that ability.
No, you don't. But you do have the ability to require reporting.
Yes.
Particularly reporting in terms of compliance. Okay? And that is one of the best ways that you find out. Also, you also find out by doing auditing. All right? But that's more mundane. I would say the best way to exercise your oversight is by requiring reporting that is reporting to get to the kinds of issues that you want to know. Not reporting that's necessarily designed by staff, but reporting that is designed to identify issues that you believe create the most significant risk to you. Do you all have an internal auditor? Or I'm guessing an internal audit position?
Yes.
Okay. That's another way. All right. Making sure that you know what the internal auditor's plan is, what the issues are, and that you get reporting on that. Does that seem I think that's reasonable. Hopefully you do too.
No, that's helpful.
Okay. So going to slide 41, I think a lot of the Stanford Institutional Investors Forum And this is a quote that I'm often fond of. Good governance helps to ensure better organizational performance, fewer conflicts of interest, and higher probability that goals and objectives will be attained, and less opportunity for misuse of fund assets. So let's talk about some pitfalls. Going to slide 43, all right, here's some of the characteristics of poor governance. Lack of transparency and accountability because roles are not properly defined and understood. Failure to disclose activities. That goes to what we were talking about. What are you doing? What activities are going on? You know, how are you implementing certain things? And inadequate oversight and reporting. All right. Reporting is key. And reporting, again, that gets to the issues and types of risks that you are most concerned about. Right? Poor documentation, okay, is another characteristic of poor governance. You need that documentation on both sides. Documentation in terms of what are the expectations, and documentation in terms of those expectations are being fulfilled, okay? Inconsistent decision making. That's a big one for me. If it's in a process, if you say this is the criteria, then you follow that criteria, okay? If you're not following the criteria for B that you followed for A, you need to have a reason why if A and B are the same, okay? High tolerance for conflicts. I don't see this as much now as I used to see it, but some organizations do have a high tolerance for conflicts of interest. They don't think it's necessarily a big deal. Also, it has to be remembered that conflicts of interest are inherent in the financial industry. The key there is knowing what the conflicts are and knowing that there is a mitigation process in place to handle them. Micromanagement is another characteristic of poor governance, okay? You know, design the path, but let staff row the boat to it or drive the car to it, okay? Just make sure that you're getting to the destination that you want to. No strategic plan or strategic direction. So we'll talk about on slide later in this how you go about mitigating some of those. So examples of fiduciary pitfalls, some of the ones, and this is on slide 44, failure to document decisions, failure to identify problems and take action when needed, failure to evaluate staff and key service providers. So do you all have the ability to evaluate the CIO? That's a question.
I imagine we have the ability, but I don't believe we exercise it. Like okay. In a process-oriented way, right? We're not having reviews, if that's kind of what you're suggesting.
So does the treasurer ask you for feedback? And if not, the treasurer might want to ask you about feedback to make sure that you're satisfied with the performance of not only the CIO, but the people who, you know, the key people who report into the CIO. Are you getting the kinds of information that you need? And Rex, don't kill me later.
Not at all. I think that's
yeah, I was waiting to answer that question because I wanted others to, but certainly that kind of feedback is helpful, helpful input for sure.
So, now all of that said, going back to trust but verify, a pitfall is rubber stamping your staff and your service providers. It makes staff and service providers better when you challenge them and you don't just follow what they say blindly. it's amazing to me how you get much better advice, you get much more productive output if people know, oh, they're not just going to take what I say. I've got to be able to defend this. I've got to have a good rationale behind this. Other pitfalls, failure to follow plan documents, failure to monitor service providers, failure to adequately delegate, all right? Delegation is clearly something that we are seeing more and more of, but with many funds, it's very, very reluctant. People like that control. People like the beauty contest where you bring in, you know, the high-rolling investment managers and people get to talk to them. They like that, but that might not be the highest and best use of their time. Failure to adopt an annual work plan and lack of autonomy needed to carry out your mission. So I think I heard, and I wouldn't be surprised, that you all don't have the type of autonomy or independence that you need in order to get the resources that you need to carry out your mission.
It's an interesting question. I'll jump in here, Tobias Reed. The I think we would always like to have more. We've had pretty good success going to the legislature for the positions that we need, and spend a lot of effort on that relationship so that success can continue. But ultimately, we have to get approval from the legislature in most cases.
He who has the goal often controls, and you don't want to be dependent on relationships, but many public funds are dependent on relationships. Unfortunately, relationships change, priorities change, you know, so it's difficult. Ideally, you should have independent budgetary authority, independent procurement authority, and independent personnel authority. Okay?
We do have personnel and procurement. It's the positions that are essentially required to get approval from the legislature.
And are those positions paid for out of plan assets?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I'm laughing because when I was executive director, I had to furlough my staff because the District of Columbia was furloughing its personnel. And it's like, but guys, this is not helping your bottom line at all.
Totally, you know? Agree.
This is optics.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
Well, John Russell again. I'm a believer in something that I haven't ever implemented. I'm a believer in the true 360 review process that ideally is annual. Presumably, Tobias, that's something you would do with Rex, and presumably Rex, something you would do with your key people. But are those reviews done that way?
We have an evolving process on that, but yeah, we're definitely taking feedback from a variety of perspectives. And Rex is on his way back. I had to run out real quickly, so he'll be here in a second.
But is that systematized, Tobias?
Yeah.
Annual?
Yeah.
Good.
Okay. So,
Rex, I was saying that I'm a believer in a system that I've never implemented, which is annual 360 reviews. Do you do that with your key people?
Not officially, no. Not an official 360 review, but we do definitely have a consistent annual review process, though, where I get feedback, you know, obviously from my bosses and so on. So, but yeah, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a 360 review per se.
Well, I don't think it has to be that complex as long as it's annual and written.
It is. Absolutely.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Good questions. Good dialogue. So let's go to slide 47, We're going to talk about some governance practices to mitigate those pitfalls that we just discussed. So these are elements of good governance: monitoring, independence, transparency, and accountability, all the things that, you know, we have been talking about. Having efficient board meetings, effective leadership, and having a plan, having a culture of conflict avoidance, speaking in one voice. Those are all things that are elements of good governance. So breaking it down further, if I go to slide 48, examples of good governance practices would be knowledge, being informed about policies and process, being engaged, you know, attending meetings and being prepared for them, documentation. How many times have you heard me talk about documentation today? Making sure that you're conducting due diligence. So that due diligence is not just respect to managers, but due diligence in terms of knowing what's going on in the pension industry, what other institutional investors are doing. Again, based on the duty of prudence, that doesn't mean you have to do what they do, but that means that your decisions should be informed about what's going on in the industry, okay? Now, following your plan documents, we've already talked about compliance. We talked about that a little bit in terms of understanding what's required, what policies have you all put in place, and determining whether or not it's actually being done, and whether or not you have to change things. So integrity, avoiding conflicts, acting in good faith, having a work plan, understanding what authority you have retained and what authority you've delegated. So the what, the when, and the who. Who's responsible? When does it have to be done? Is it being done? Going back to compliance. Monitoring, all right? Monitoring of performance, whether it be manager performance, staff performance, monitoring of fees, and having good benchmarking in place. And then diversity, okay? And when I talk about diversity here, I'm talking about different views, avoiding groupthink, all right? Having diverse discussions makes for better decision-making. So that's why all those things are examples of good governance practices. Going to slide 49, let's talk about some of those hexagons in terms of practical application. So skilled leadership, facing the tough issues in a manner that's consistent with your fiduciary duties, coordinating efforts among OIC members, speaking in one voice. Now, you can have diversity of opinion, but once you as a committee, a council, have decided this is the way that we're going to go down this route, speaking in one voice and transferring that one voice to the treasurer and his staff, okay? So some questions to think about. Does the OIC know what it's supposed to do? Is the leadership shared among OIC members? Are the responsibilities of OIC members clearly documented? Are meetings run in an effective, efficient manner? Okay? Those are just some questions to think about, you know. Slide 50, policies and procedures.
Gina, while you're on that slide, I never have minded votes that are not unanimous on decisions. So the speaking of one voice requirement, I don't necessarily concur with that.
Well, no. I said once you have decided as an OIC what the decision is, so you don't have – that doesn't require unanimous vote. Speaking in one voice doesn't mean unanimous vote. Speaking in one voice, if you have a 4-3 decision, then whatever that decision is the one voice. Okay? So the three that didn't agree have to get on board with what the one voice is, even though they voted against it. So that's right. What one voice means.
Understood. Thanks.
Okay. Policies and procedures. So let's think about some questions to ask here. Do you have, do you know what the written policies are and which ones the OIC must comply with? Are policies clear and unambiguous? Do the policies address the right issues? Do the policies evolve what the current circumstances are? Or in other words, the ever-evolving best practices in the industry or the practice in the industry. Is policy compliance formally monitored? So I have seen organizations, for example, with wonderful policies, but they never monitor them. They never monitor them to see whether or not they are actually being carried out, whether it be with your investment managers or whether it be with your staff. Okay? These are some of the benefits of having policies. It provides a paper trail, helps to ensure, therefore, that you acted prudently. It ensures continuity. It reassures your stakeholders because if they come in and they want to know what's going on, you know, you can say, we're acting consistently with our policies and procedures. This is what they are, and this is what we're doing. and it identifies responsibilities in terms of providing a roadmap to fiduciaries. Slide 52, having efficient meetings. Meetings are where the work gets done. How many meetings do you all have per year? Somebody answer.
It's every 6 weeks.
Okay. So that is the time that you come together. That is the time that you make decisions. You monitor the decisions that are being made. Good meetings facilitate good decision-making. Okay? So does the OIC have the right number of meetings to accomplish the work that it needs to get done? One of the ways to determine that, and one of my other clients who wanted to go to fewer meetings did an annual work plan. And they assigned, you know, to each of their meetings what they had to get done over the year to see if there was an opportunity to more streamline meetings. Okay? Are agendas established appropriately? Is there appropriate allocation of time? All right. You don't want to rush through things just to get out of a meeting. You want to make sure you've allocated sufficient time to deal with important decision making. Also, are the meeting materials that you get useful to that decision making? And do you get them sufficiently in advance so you have time to prepare and ask the right questions? Are different points of view allowed to be heard? Again, that goes to diversity of opinions. Are discussions focused? You know, sometimes when you're going through a discussion, people go off on a tangent. So it's important to bring them back in. and do OIC members try to balance multiple roles when they have a duty of loyalty that requires undivided loyalty?
Well, for what it's worth, I would give us an A-plus on both slide 51 and 52. The policies are something we're very aware of. They're constantly being changed and improved. The meetings, thanks to the agendas being set up, I think are efficient. So I'm pleased with where we are.
Good. Hopefully your fellow council members agree with you.
We'll see.
Okay. Effective meeting minutes. Now, I argue with my fellow attorneys all the time about what should be in minutes and what shouldn't be in minutes. The fundamental role of minutes is to preserve an accurate and official record. So how are you going to show that you followed a prudent process if the minutes don't have what the process that you followed in them is? Some would argue, well, then it becomes a swearing contest and you have to prove that I didn't do it. But I don't really like that argument, but it's often made. But minutes serve as documentation that the deliberative process was engaged in, and it helps to demonstrate that you acted consistently with your fiduciary responsibilities. And because of that, it helps to minimize the potential fiduciary liability. Slide 54, transparency and accountability. Transparency and accountability are the fundamental tenets of good governance. Collectively and individually, it helps to demonstrate that your actions were consistent with the duty of loyalty and the duty of prudence. So don't operate in the dark. Operate in the light, because a lack of transparency and accountability sends the wrong message to your stakeholders, okay? And when you send them the wrong message, that's when you get Freedom of Information Act requests, people trying to sit in your meeting, you know, media people trying to sit in your meeting to see what you're doing and reporting on it. I mean, it's much better to be transparent than to have to fight, you know, and explain what you did and why you did it when you did it in the dark. So with that in mind, slide 55 talks about conducting business in open meetings, clearly reporting your business decisions that you made, again, establishing written policies, maintaining control procedures, publishing your meeting minutes, having an annual report, and having a website that has what activities the OIC is engaging in. Slide 56, delegation and oversight. So 56. Okay, so the OIC is the ultimate governing fiduciary. However, you have the ability to delegate. The Prudent Investor Act, as well as ERISA, even encourages delegation, okay? But when you delegate, as we've talked about, you've got to have adequate monitoring, which assists you in making sure that you can fulfill your oversight responsibilities. So questions to think about are asked: are the right people at the right level making the decisions? Is there clear documentation of what authority has been retained, what's been delegated, and to whom? Are reports sufficient for the oversight of your responsibilities by the OIC? Are staff and outside service providers held accountable? Which, I mean, all of these things, you should hear a lot of redundancy by this time in the things that we have been talking about. So I mentioned early on that we would talk about, or as Alan put it, the different clients that you have. This is a list of many of the funds. I think I got most of them, the investment funds under the purview of the OIC. Okay? So that's just a little informational thing for you all. Now I'm going to turn, and how are we doing for time, guys? Hello.
I think we're doing just fine.
Okay. So now I'm going to turn it over to Kristen to talk about hot topics.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think we're a little behind, but thanks, Rex. I will make this quick. So as Jenna mentioned, we do have a couple relevant, timely hot topics that we want the OIC to consider. And most likely, these are topics that you've heard of, that you've read about, and hopefully actually thought about in recent months. So I don't think they'll be surprised that these are the ones that were top of mind for us. So if you can go to the next slide. The first one is around something that's top of mind in every industry, and that's cybersecurity. And then for today, obviously, We're going to talk about this in the context of a plan sponsor's fiduciary responsibility for addressing cybersecurity risk. The DOL actually recently issued guidance on best practices for maintaining cybersecurity and how to address the risk. And again, we'll talk about the DOL quite a bit under this, the hot topic section. And remember that, you know, Jenna did kind of talk about the relevance of ERISA. We recognize that public pension plans aren't necessarily under ERISA, but we, as we usually do, recommend that you pay attention to what the DOL guidance is. So we've summarized here what that guidance is from the DOL in regards to cybersecurity risk. And I'll just sort of summarize them briefly. But the first one is they've provided some guidance and some tips for hiring a service provider with strong cybersecurity practices. So this is guidance around like what questions to ask service providers, how to evaluate a provider's track record, and how to actually what are sort of contracting standards? What should those look like? Number two is also related to service providers. So identifying what are the DOL identifies a list of best practices. Sorry, if you can go back one, I haven't gone to the next slide yet. Thanks. Identify best practices that service providers should abide by. And so what this does is then provides a way for you as fiduciaries to measure the practices that your service providers have in place relative to this list of best practices that they've identified. It's a good measurement tool. And then the third is all about the external the actual plan participants, which is educating and providing guidance to plan participants that actually use online access and how to protect their own personal information. So this is really good guidance from the DOL, in our opinion. As this risk has continued to become more prevalent, more present, and it has certainly increased, we have our own recommendations for what plan sponsors should consider when addressing cybersecurity risk. And it does, that guidance does incorporate the DOL guidance that I just summarized, but it goes a few steps further. So if you go to the next slide, please, I'll just summarize some of our recommendations. So the first one is, and this is, you know, you will have heard Jenna obviously talk about process and how having a prudent process is very important. And so similarly with this topic, establishing a process for evaluating data security safeguards is extremely important. And this also kind of harkens to the DOL guidance around having a process to mitigate cybersecurity risk. This should include a review and an evaluation of both internal and external safeguards. So while the DOL sort of focuses more on like your external service providers, you want to remember that there's an internal component to evaluating cybersecurity risk and process as well. And Jenna, by the way, just wanted to mention, please, you can, and anyone can interrupt me and stop me as I go through this if you have any comments or questions. And then second, we believe that what you should do, what we would call a baseline assessment. And this is really to assess what has been established to date in terms of cybersecurity risk mitigation. And importantly, are the things that are in place actually applicable to what we would to plan data. So this might seem really obvious, but not all mitigants are created equal. And so you want to make sure that those mitigants in place are actually applicable to the actual data that you're trying to safeguard. And then we do recommend considering hiring an external independent review by a third party when establishing this baseline assessment. And I think it's pretty obvious why we would recommend something like that. Third, through this evaluation, what you hopefully will identify is determining where data is protected and where there are weaknesses. And then the next step would be to set up a process to make improvements or updates to that process, which is sort of noted under the document actions. And then again, to harken back to something that Jenna emphasized over the last hour and a half, is that documentation is key. So documenting this process and then repeating it every so often in whatever cadence seems most reasonable for the organization is going to be the fine point that you put on this, on the cybersecurity risk mitigation. Any questions or comments regarding
just a question, risk? John Russell, a question of Tobias and Rex. What's difficult about this is that the the rules and the activities are constantly changing. How satisfied are you two that we are up to speed about all the risks? That we have the right internal people, the right external people, and I guess in part of that, when do we on the council get a report about your opinions about those things?
Well, I had to the first part, and then Rex can finish up. I feel really good about where we are in terms of our capacity and the quality of people. That's been an ongoing conversation with the legislature, who occasionally wants to centralize cybersecurity issues, and we push back on that, pointing out the different and specialized requirements that we have as opposed to other parts of state government, and that's been successful so far. It's also worth noting, I think, something that I understood the point about interacting with planned participants. That would not be so much us as it would be PERS itself. So that's an important distinction as well. But I feel good about where we are. Rex, add anything to?
Yeah.
Kevin here, just as a note. Yeah, PERS has its own information security group that works with the Department of Administrative Services, and we do regular cybersecurity tests and upgrades and everything else. We just went through one and got some really good marks from the state on our cybersecurity.
Thanks for adding that in, Kevin.
And then from my perspective, this is Rex Kam. One of the things that we've been talking about internally is not just the investment due diligence, but the operational due diligence. And so we've started engaging with some of your consultants in trying to better understand how they think about cybersecurity as a part of our and their operational due diligence process. But that is something that we will continue to try to build on.
And Rex, can we expect an annual review of that at the council level?
I think that would be a good idea.
All right, great. So I will move on to, if you can flip to the next slide, to the second topic. And this is related to ESG and proxy voting. So ESG is obviously a topic that we've been spending a lot of time on at the OIC. And again, this pertains to the DOL guidance around these two topics. And in this case, as many of you probably know, we have rules that were enacted under the previous administration in late 2020, technically adopted very early in 2021, that the DOL under the new administration is saying that they will not enforce. It technically is still in place, but they will not enforce the current rule as written. And then in October of this year, the DOL issued a proposed rule. The title of it is here. It's a little bit of a mouthful, but I'll go through the changes. But the most significant change from this rule to the previous rule is that it allows for the consideration of non-pecuniary factors. And important to note that we're still in the comment period for that new rule for about another 2 weeks. If you go to the next slide, this is just a quick chronology of this issue. Over the past year or so, like I said, we had the current rule go into effect in January. Then in March, the DOL announced a non-enforcement policy regarding financial factors in selecting plan investments, and then the fiduciary duties regarding proxy voting. It's sort of a precursor to the actual rule that was then proposed, as I mentioned, in October and is currently in its comment period. The current rule states that as a minimum requirement for meeting the standard of loyalty and fiduciary care, fiduciaries must evaluate investments and investment courses of action based solely on pecuniary factors and based on appropriate investment horizons. And the rule in its current form makes it very clear that fiduciaries cannot sacrifice returns or increase risk to promote non-financial goals. And that may include environmental or social causes, for example. It also goes on to say that if a fiduciary uses non-financial factors to choose among investments that are otherwise indistinguishable financially, the rule requires documentation proving that such decisions were made with appropriately careful analysis and evaluation. So it doesn't necessarily prohibit investments that support non-financial goals.